they are injured in the street and somebody can move to bring them.
Israeli soldiers have launched a full-scale attack on northern Gaza, reportedly blowing up at least a dozen residential buildings and storming Khan al-Adwan Hospital, forcing out patients and staff. We'll get an update from the acting director of Al-Awda Hospital in the Jabalia refugee camp. And we'll be joined by the Palestinian poet and author, Mossab Abu Toha. He's just published his new book of poetry, Forest of Noise.
It is really devastating to think that after a year, the world is still thinking about October 7th only, rather than about the years and decades before October 7th and the many and long, long days and weeks that followed October 7th.
And the BRICS summit has just wrapped up in Russia, where President Vladimir Putin made a comeback to the global stage, hosting 36 world leaders and representatives from countries including China, India, South Africa, Iran, Venezuela, and even Palestine. Many heads of states demanded a Gaza ceasefire. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In northern Gaza, Israeli soldiers have launched a full-scale attack on Jabalia. Details are still emerging on what a Gaza civil defense spokesperson described as a major massacre, with more than 150 people killed or injured as Israeli forces took down a dozen residential buildings. Late Thursday, Israeli forces stormed Khan al-Adwan Hospital, expelling patients and staff after earlier surrounding and shelling what was essentially the last hospital left standing in the area. Soldiers carried out mass arrests. Doctors say babies and children have died after being cut off from their oxygen supplies. Khan al-Adwan's director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, says the situation is catastrophic, that there is nowhere patients in northern Gaza can go for treatment. After headlines, we'll go to northern Gaza to speak with the acting director of Khan al-Adwan, Mohammed Salha. Israeli attacks in the southern Gaza Strip continue as well. In Khan Yunis, at least 38 people were killed by Israel, including 14 children from the same family. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he expects Gaza ceasefire talks to resume in the coming days in Doha. In Lebanon, an Israeli strike killed three journalists as they slept in a guest house in the southern town of Hasbaya. Israel did not issue any evacuation orders for the area before the strike. The victims were Al-Mayadeen journalist Hassan Najjar and Mohammed Reda and Wissam Qasim of Amanar TV. Al-Mayadeen reporter Abbas Sabah addressed his colleagues' killing earlier today from Lebanon.
Israel targeted journalists in Hasbaya, knowing that the area is known for the gathering of journalists. This enemy that looks for civilian targets after it's drained its military targets and lost in the field is now targeting journalists.
Lebanon's information minister called the attack a war crime. The official death toll from Israel's assault on Lebanon is nearing 2,600. In Russia, 36 world leaders have wrapped up a summit of the BRICS alliance led by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, with a pledge to add 13 new partners. The newly expanded BRICS will include Algeria, Belarus, Bolivia, Cuba, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Malaysia, Nigeria, Thailand, Turkey, Uganda, Uzbekistan, and Vietnam. Venezuela failed in its bid to join BRICS after Brazil vetoed its admission. The Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has said he would not accept the result of July's election, in which Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro claimed to narrowly win re-election. We'll have more on the BRICS summit later in the broadcast. In the Philippines, Tropical Storm Trami has killed at least 26 people after dumping torrential rains across the main island of Luzon. At least 14 of the deaths were in Batangas province.
I was panicking. I was looking for my child. He was missing. When I got here, all the houses were gone. Everything was buried in mud. There was also two residents looking for their family under the mud.
The United Nations Environment Program warns without dramatic cuts to greenhouse gas emissions, the world will face an inevitable and catastrophic temperature rise of 3.1 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a stark warning as he announced the findings.
The message of today's emissions gap report is clear. We are teetering on a planetary tightrope. Either leaders bridge the emissions gap, or we plunge headlong into climate disaster, with the poorest and most vulnerable suffering the most.
King Charles has joined leaders of 56 nations, most of them former British colonies, for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which opened today in Samoa's capital, Apia. Two dozen of the Commonwealth's nations are small island states, making the threat of rising seas and worsening tropical storms a priority at this year's summit. A new report finds the Commonwealth's three wealthiest members, Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, are responsible for 60% of its greenhouse gas emissions, even though they comprise just 6% of the Commonwealth's population. Ahead of the talks, Tuvalu's prime minister called on nations to back a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty.
To put it plainly, it is a death sentence, not phrases that I use lightly. For us, Tuvalu, if larger nations continue to increase their emission levels, a fossil fuel treaty will be a global mechanism essential for managing a just transition away from coal, oil, and gas.
Meanwhile, King Charles has refused calls by African and Caribbean nations to pay reparations and make amends for Britain's role in the transatlantic slave trade. In remarks opening the Commonwealth Summit, Charles stopped short of an apology. He instead acknowledged painful aspects of Britain's past. In Mozambique, protests broke out after Daniel Chapo of the ruling Frelimo party was announced the winner of a disputed presidential election Thursday.
I don't believe that Frelimo won. I think Frelimo did what they always do. What's happening today is people are suffering.
Chapo's biggest rival, Venancio Mondlane, has called on supporters to keep taking to the streets in protest. Earlier this week, police deployed tear gas and fired on demonstrators who rallied after the murder of Mondlane's lawyer and a party official. Issues in this year's election included Mozambique's debt crisis, corruption, climate change-driven disasters, and a violent insurgency in the north of the country. Here in New York, a group of protesters gathered outside the Dominican consulate in the Bronx Thursday to denounce the mass deportation of Haitians by the Dominican Republic. Earlier this month, the Dominican president, Luis Abinader, announced a campaign to expel up to 10,000 Haitians a week, citing an excess of immigrants. In the last 3 weeks, over 27,000 people have been deported to Haiti. This is Dr. Saudi Garcia. The expulsions come as the UN says more than 10,000 Haitians were internally displaced over the past week after fleeing gang attacks around the capital, Port-au-Prince. In campaign news, Donald Trump rallied in Tempe, Arizona Thursday, where he unleashed another torrent of anti-immigrant hate speech.
Kamala's migrant invasion, given to us through gross incompetence, disqualifies her from even thinking about being president. And we're a dumping ground. We're like a garbage can for the world. That's what's happened.
Trump deployed a similar hate-filled rhetoric at another Thursday rally in Las Vegas, where he also claimed he was leading by a lot in swing states, even as most polls put him neck and neck with Kamala Harris. Meanwhile, in Clarkston, Georgia, Kamala Harris shared the stage with Barack Obama for the first time during her campaign as she touted her support for abortion rights, her proposals to lift up the middle class. The star-studded rally included Spike Lee, Samuel L. Jackson, and Tyler Perry in a performance from Bruce Springsteen. As of Wednesday, nearly 2 million Georgian voters cast early ballots, a record for Georgia. The immigrant justice group, Al Otro Lado, celebrated a major legal victory this week after a federal appeals court ruled in favor of its class action lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. The case challenged the illegal practice by Customs and Border Protection of turning away asylum seekers at U.S. ports of entry without due process, forcing them to wait in border cities, often in extremely dangerous and precarious situations. And President Biden is visiting the Gila Crossing Community School in Arizona today, where he'll issue a formal apology for government-run Native American boarding schools, which separated indigenous families and sought to eliminate Native cultures. The U.S. government operated hundreds of these schools from 1819 to 1969. Where children reported severe physical and psychological abuse. An Interior Department investigation this year found nearly 1,000 children died while at the schools. Biden will be accompanied by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first ever Native American cabinet secretary. Haaland is a member of the Pueblo of Laguna. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in northern Gaza, where Israeli soldiers launched a full-scale attack on Jabalia earlier today, blowing up a dozen residential buildings. Gaza officials described the attack as a major massacre and warned of mass casualties, with more than 150 people reportedly killed or injured. Late Thursday, Israeli forces stormed Kamal Adwan Hospital, expelling patients and staff after earlier surrounding and shelling what was essentially the last hospital left standing in the area. Soldiers carried out mass arrests. Doctors say babies and children have died after being cut off from their oxygen supplies. Kamal Adwan's director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, says the situation is catastrophic and there's nowhere patients in northern Gaza can go for treatment. This comes as displaced mothers in northern Gaza are calling on the world to demand the resumption of the polio vaccination campaign for children there, which the World Health Organization said Wednesday had been postponed due to Israeli attacks and lack of access.
If the polio vaccination is not available in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, the children will be paralyzed. They will collapse in front of our eyes. They won't move. Is this fair? We demand the world to allow the entry of the polio vaccination into the northern part of the Gaza Strip to protect our children from the polio virus.
For more, Democracy Now! Reached Dr. Mohammed Salha, acting director of Al-Auda Hospital in the Jabalia refugee camp in North Gaza late Thursday night. He described what's happening on the ground.
Today is the 20 days of siege in North Gaza, and the fifth day of the siege in Al-Auda Hospital, totally siege in Al-Auda Hospital with a tank, so we can't move outside the hospital. And from the beginning of this stage, they are bombing our two inpatient departments and bombing our water tank. So now we have more than 70% of the hospital without water because the tank is destroyed, totally destroyed, the water tank. And also this afternoon, they are bombing our central store related to medical supplies. After today, we will not have the fuel to run in the hospital, and we have a lot of patients inside the hospital. We have 43 of patients here, and we can't deal with this because every day we are doing to them operation and the treatment in the under GA inside our OT, and we need medication, medical supplies, and the fuel, and also food. We don't have food, and we don't have healthy water and filtered water. Our message to the freedom people in the world, really, to stop the genocide in Gaza Strip, and especially in the north in Gaza. You can't imagine how the situation here, the people are dying in the street. They are injured in the street and nobody can move to bring them. Now we hear the massacre for more than 150. When I speak with me in Jabalia camp, but there is nobody can go there to save these people. Really, we need also WHO, UN agencies, and our partner really do urgent appeal and urgent to come to the hospital to bring our needs from medication and medical supplies, and especially from fuel, food, and healthy water for patients here.
That was Dr. Mohammed Salha, acting director of Al-Adha Hospital, speaking late Thursday night to Democracy Now! We attempted to reach him live right now, but we could not get any kind of connection. When we come back, we'll be joined by Palestinian poet and author Mosab Abu Toha. He's just published his new book of poetry, Forest of Noise.
سقطت على التراب مسربلا بفيها جراحي وتدفقت منك الدماء وما لفي جنبي سلاحي أنا إن سقطت على التراب مسربلا بفيها جراحي وتدفقت منك الدماء وما لفي جنبي سلاحي وتخطفت جسدي الطيور الحائمات على الفطاح هذا طريقي في الكفاح فيا أخي فيا أخي من كفاحي أنا إن سقطت على التراب مسربلا بكيا جراحي وتدفقت منك الدماء وما لفي جنبي سلاحي أنا إن سقطت على التراب مسربلا بكيا جراحي وتدفقت منك الدماء وما لفي جنبي سلاحي وتخطفت جسد الطيور الحائمات على البطاح هذا طريقي في الكفاح
If I Should Fall, from the 1974 album Palestine Lives, released by Paradon Records. Musician and label co-founder Barbara Dane passed away this week at the age of 97. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As human rights activists plead with global leaders for immediate action, calling for an end to Israel's genocide in Gaza, Jordan's foreign minister met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in London today and condemned the humanitarian catastrophe in northern Gaza, telling Blinken, quote, we do see ethnic cleansing taking place and that has got to stop, he said. For more, we're joined by Palestinian poet and author from Gaza, who writes in his new book of poems, If You Live in Gaza, You Die Several Times. Mosab Abu Toha's second book of poetry is just out. It's titled Forest of Noise. His previous award-winning book of poetry, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. Mosab Abu Toha is a columnist, a teacher, founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza. His recent essay in the New York Times is headlined, Gaza's Schools Are for Learning, Not for Dying. And his latest piece for the New Yorker is headlined, The Gaza We Leave Behind. Mosab Abu Toha, it's wonderful to have you in studio safely here in New York, but I know that your heart and mind are in Gaza right now. Before we talk about your poetry, you have just come with terrible news for you and your family about what is happening there. Can you describe what you've heard just today?
Thank you so much, Amy. just you mentioned the airstrikes that took down 10 residential buildings. I was staying with that in that place with my wife and kids. Just before we had to leave for an UNRWA school to stay in a shelter there, and before I was abducted by the Israeli army. And this morning I looked at the names of some of the people who were killed in that airstrike. And I see that, 19 names from the same family, including Imfathi Abu Rashid, a temporary neighbor. We had Imfathi as a neighbor for a few days before we had to leave the neighborhood. And now I read that this neighborhood, where I was staying with them, was bombed. So she was killed along with some of her children. And this is the case of so many people. I'm not sure if you can see this. This is the list of the whole family. And for example,
they're holding up a list of some 20 names?
Yeah, 20 names, including Imfathi, the grandmother, her children, and her grandchildren. And I look at the, for example, I read this every day. So there is Muhammad Salman, his brother Yusuf, Islam, Sama'aya. So five brothers. And then there is Mahmoud Fathi, the son of Fathi, Abu Rashid, and his wife and their children. So I've been seeing all this all the time. And by the way, we are focusing right now on North Gaza. Yesterday, late at night, Israel bombed intensely Khan Yunis. And I'm looking at some of the pictures here. These are the photos of the children who were killed yesterday. they just were able to withdraw the bodies of these children after the Israelis retreated from the area. So, that was today. I learned about this just half an hour ago. And then I went to the local news channel in my city, Beit Lahia, North Gaza, and I saw the picture of my neighbor, Ayman Abu Layla. This is his photo. He was killed this morning while he was trying to get some water from a tap in the street. Ayman, to honor his memory, he was the principal of the Oni Agricultural College in North Gaza. And he was trying it, by the way. He lived just a few blocks away, and he wanted to move to stay with his brother because there are some friends and some neighbors who are staying there. So he wanted to be close to the people who are there. But he was killed, and his son, my wife just told me, because she was on the phone with her mother and father, who are trapped right now in Beit Lahia, they were told that the brother of my neighbor has been critically wounded, and he is in the house. There's no way that an ambulance can come. There is no way that anyone can come to their rescue. And the same thing happened yesterday in the Jebel refugee camp, the 10 residential buildings that were took down.
Musab, yesterday, last night, I saw you at the Brooklyn Public Library, sold out to hear you speak about your poetry. And you said at the beginning, I saw your wife and your three little children, but that hadn't been the plan. Now in Syracuse, at Syracuse University. Yeah. Talk about you almost canceling the day before because your wife was too terrified for you to come to New York.
Indeed, I mean, taking my wife and three kids with me was a last-minute decision. I mean, the Israeli army has been, horribly attacking North Gaza, displacing people, and kidnapping, like abducting doctors and nurses and journalists and even the injured people. They had to evacuate. I just imagine, I mean, people who have been injured and they had some medical care and they had to be on some medical equipment. They are taken away from the hospital. Some of them would die. And that's why the Lancet Journal said that more than 200,000 people have been have died or were killed by the Israeli airstrike, the Israeli military campaign since October 7th. So my wife's family, including her father, her mother, her siblings, and some of the nephews and nieces, her grandparents too, aged 75, they are now trapped in the family house, and they are unable to leave. And now the Ata Abu Layla, my neighbor, was killed just a few meters away from them by a missile shrapnel from a tank shell. So she worries that if I'm away from her, and she gets some terrible news like today's news, she would die from pain and grief. So she wanted me to be with her, and so I told her I couldn't cancel, you know, the event at the Brooklyn Public Library and also my event today at NYU. So I said, okay, you come with me, and now she came with me, as if this would, I mean, I don't claim, I don't say that I would make her feelings better, because I too have family in Beit Lahia. I have a young sister with three children. The youngest is 2 years old. And I haven't talked to her for about 10 days. It's impossible to get in touch with my sister. I don't know how she's surviving or whether she's alive at this moment.
You wrote on social media 6 days ago, "I write with a heavy heart that my cousin Sama, 7 years old, has been killed in the airstrike on their house, along with 18 members of her family, which is my extended family." Yeah. For our TV audience, we are showing an image of Sama now. Yeah. Tell us who she is.
So Sama is one of the five children of my aunt Asma, who was also injured. The mother, I mean, in the house. Sama was staying with her parents, with her siblings, with her grandmother, who happens to be my grandmother's sister. And I used to call her grandmother because my grandmother passed away when I was very young. So my grandmother's sister, with two of her daughters and her grandchildren, and two of her daughter-in-laws and the grandchildren, are still buried under the rubble until this moment. So Sama was killed in the airstrike. And the only reason why my aunt and her other children, or even though they were wounded, the only reason why they were not killed is that they were staying close to the door. Because the bomb, when it falls, it usually hits the middle of the house. So my aunt Asma survived the airstrike with some injuries, along with her husband and other four children. And they had, by the way, they were my aunt had to walk to the Israeli soldiers who were standing just a few meters away from the bombed house. So just imagine a criminal killing you and then waiting for you until you are either dead or come to them limping. And she told me that she kissed their hands, begging them to leave them alone. And if she could take with her some wheat flour from the house that she was keeping next to her, because there is no food in Gaza. So Sana was 7 years old, and I remember something very clearly, which is that every time I visited my aunt's house, especially during the Eid, the you know, after the Ramadan and after, you know, the pilgrimage season. So we have two big Eids or feasts. So I used to visit my aunt, and her children are there. And this photo is from, I think you showed it, but this is from the Eid. This is her dress. And my aunt would bring a sheet of paper and ask her daughters, including Sama, yalla, because I'm an English language teacher. So she said, yalla, show Mus'ab. Show Mus'ab the new words that you have learned, the colors, the animals. But now Sama, I mean, I did not have the chance to bid her farewell. This is my cousin. And I lost 31 members of my extended family, including three first cousins, two of them with their husband and children. I didn't get just the chance even to see them before they were buried. And I didn't know whether some of them had any part of their bodies intact after the airstrikes. So just imagine the magnitude of loss that I'm facing as I'm just one person. Some other people lost all their families. And we know about the new term, wounded child, no surviving family. About more than 2,000 children had the same case. They were the sole survivors of their family. I mean, what future is awaiting them? No one is asking this question.
Mus'ab Abu Toha is an award-winning poet and author. He has a new book of poetry out. It's called Forest of Noise. Your descriptions now make me think of your little son. You came with your three children yesterday. Can you read the poem about your son and your daughter?
Yeah, sure. So, by the way, this poem was written after May 2021 attacks. So my son Yazan was about 5 years old. My daughter Yafa was 4 years old. And this is about them.
Now, this is very important, because you just said this is written in May 2021.
Yes.
Half your poems in Forest of Noise are before last October.
Exactly.
7th.
Yeah.
And the other half after.
Well, I mean, this tells you and others a lot of things. So this poem could be written today. And if it was written today, there are so many things that would not be present here, because this current genocide is so different from any other wars that Israel launched against the civilian population in the Gaza Strip. My son throws a blanket over my daughter. Gaza, May 2021. At night, at home, we sit on the floor close to each other, far from the windows and the red lights of bombs. Our backs bang on the walls whenever the house shakes. We stare at each other's faces, scared yet happy that so far our lives have been spared. The walls wake up from their fitful sleep, no arms to wipe at their blurry eyes. Flies gather around the only lit ceiling lamp for warmth in the bitter night, cold except when missiles hit and burn up houses and roads and the trees. The neighborhood next to us, where Yazan learned to ride his bike, scorched. Every time we hear a bomb falling from an F-16 or an F-35, our lives panic. Our lives freeze somewhere in between, confused where to head next. A graveyard, a hospital, a nightmare. I keep my shivering hand on my wristwatch, ready to remove the battery if needed. My four-year-old daughter Yafa, wearing a pink dress given to her by a friend, hears a bomb explode. She gasps, covers her mouth with her dress's ruffles. Yazan, her 5.5-year-old brother, grabs a blanket worn by his sleepy buddy. He lays the blanket on his sister. "You can hide now," he assures her. And I have a video of that. It's on my phone. I took a video of my son throwing a blanket. That's how I couldn't forget this moment.
Now, your kids know the hospitals in Gaza that we were just describing.
Yeah.
Tell us, to humanize Kamal Adwan Hospital, Al-Alda Hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, by the way, Al Awda Hospital, so Kamal Adwan is run by the Gaza Health Ministry. The Al Awda Hospital is run by the Palestinian Red Crescent, which is an NGO. And the Al Awda Hospital is dedicated mainly to the people who cannot afford to pay health insurance, and many of the pregnant mothers who go to UNRWA clinics are referred to Al Awda Hospital to give birth there for free. So it's a hospital not only for the patient but also for the pregnant women to give birth. My sister Aya, 35 years old, is pregnant and she's about to give birth. And there is no hospital close to her, so I don't know what she's going to do. Kamal Adwan Hospital is the main hospital in Beit Lahia and also in Beit Lahia Project. And in the past few years, it was turned into a children's hospital. And I used to take Yafa and Yazan to that hospital when they feel sick, when they have fever, when they are injured. And I have many friends who used to work as nurses there. And I know Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya, who is the head of the Kamal Adwan Hospital right now, who we watched just a few minutes ago. I mean, he's very helpless. I mean, I use this in my language. I say that the situation in North Gaza, in Beit Lahia, in North, is catastrophic. I mean, how many times did I use the same word? I mean, sometimes I want to stop writing because I'm repeating the same word, even though the situation is worse. So, I mean, the language is helpless. I mean, I use the same vocabulary after October 7th to describe the situation in North Gaza, in Beit Lahia. I said we had no water, no food. That was October 12th. And now we are October 25th, 2024. So does the language help us? Why does the world make us feel, helpless? I don't like this as a human being. We have never stopped shouting and screaming and showing our pictures and videos.
Can you remind our viewers and listeners who may not have seen you on Democracy Now? First, soon after October 7th, we talked to you in Gaza. We then talked to you, or spoke to others about you when you were taken by the Israeli military. Then when you were released and made it with your family to Cairo, we spoke to you.
Yeah.
We spoke to you in South Africa, and now you have come to the United States. But take us on that journey, how you got out, and remind us what happened when you were separated from your family and taken by the Israeli military.
So, Emmy, that interview that you did with me, it was October 12th. I can't forget the date because that was the last day I was in my house. I just finished my interview with you on October 12th. I think it was 3 p.m., which is 8 morning. Yeah, I didn't
right
pay attention
now,
to the
New
time.
York time.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I finished my interview with you, I went down, my father and mother, my brother Hamza and his children and his pregnant wife, my brother Muhammad and his wife, my sister Aya with her children who is now pregnant, my sister Saja and my sister Sundu. So about 25 people were in the house with me. So I went down and I found my father and my mother packing their bags. And when I talk about bags, I talk about children's school bags. We don't have suitcases, by the way, which is something that many people don't understand why. Because we don't have airports, we don't need suitcases. We travel with our backpacks, my children's kindergarten backpack. I stuffed it with some clothes, and I put some water bottle there. So I found my parents packing their bags, and I asked them, where are you going? And they said, you know, the Israelis just dropped some leaflets ordering the residents of Beit Lahia, about 90,000 people, you know, to evacuate. And that was the first time I found my parents, you know, leaving. And then I went upstairs. I didn't know what to take with me. I only took with me the only copy that I had of my first poetry book. And I took a bottle of water and some clothes for my children. And then we went to the refugee camp. And where we stayed? We stayed in the same neighborhood that was bombed yesterday, where 150 people were killed. And I just told you about the names of the people who were killed, including Mfathi, who I now remember that we got 1 hour of water from the tap when we were in the camp. And Mfathi would tell the neighbors, the water is on, fill your buckets. So I remember here. And then when the bombing got intense in the refugee camp, we thought of going to an UNRWA school, which is just a few hundred meters away from the neighborhood in the camp. So we stayed in a school shelter in Jabalia, which was later raided by the Israeli army. And by the way, a few days ago, the Israelis again visited that school, took the men out, and they have abducted so many, including my sister, my wife's sister husband. He's a brother-in-law to me. So they took him. And one reason he stayed in the school, he's a nurse. He couldn't leave the refugees in the school without any nursing person. So he was abducted, and he's left with three children. The youngest was born after October 7th. So when the bombing got intense, I had to leave the school with my wife and kids, especially because we had the chance to leave Gaza for Egypt. And on the Salah al-Din Street, which was described by the Israelis as a safe passage, I was abducted by the Israeli soldiers. I was handcuffed and blindfolded, and before that I had to remove all my clothes. I was naked for the first time in my life. And under gunpoint, two Israeli soldiers were pointing their guns at me and the person next to me. And then we were taken to a place we didn't know. I mean, it for me, as a Palestinian who was born in Gaza, I had never been to Palestine, which is now Israel. So that was the first time for me to sleep in my country. As a detainee, as someone who was blindfolded and handcuffed, as someone who didn't know that his wife and children, who he left behind, were still breathing. Just imagine, not only was I taken, and blindfolded and handcuffed and beaten and harassed and insulted. They kept saying bad words in Arabic. These are the only words they know in Arabic, insulting words. But also I did not know whether my wife and kids, from whom I was separated, were still breathing, whether they went to a place that is safe, because there is no place that is safe. Why? Because when there is occupation, there is nothing that's called a safe place. And I had also to worry about my mother and father, who I left behind in the refugee camp, and my siblings and their children. I mean, I was torn. I was torn into 100 pieces, thinking about myself. Where? Why are they taking me? Where are they taking me? And I heard some young men screaming. You know, some of them had to be separated from their pregnant wives. So after 3 days, I was released. I was dropped at the same checkpoint.
But there was international outcry, exactly, over you having been taken.
As Mus'ab Abu Toha, not as a Palestinian. So I think many people cared about me because I am a friend and a writer. But they did not maybe consider maybe doing the same thing with other people. It's easy to get someone out than getting a whole population from under the military fist of the Israeli army. I mean, I just imagine if I was not a writer, if I was not a poet, if I did not have a publisher, if I did not have some journalist and magazine that I wrote for. Just imagine, no one knew about me. I would still have been under the Israeli custody. Maybe I could have died, just like Dr. Adnan El-Borsh, who was taken from Al-Auda Hospital, by the way, in November last year. And he was announced it last October. He was the best surgeon in the Gaza Strip, and he died. He was killed.
I wanted to ask you about another man, another poet, but he didn't make it.
Yeah.
The Palestinian poet, the Islamic University professor, someone you knew, Rifat Al-Arir, last on Democracy Now, October 10th, 2023. Rifat was killed by an Israeli strike in December, along with his brother, sister, and four of his nieces. This is Scottish actor Brian Cox reciting Rifat Al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die. And then I want you to share your poem, a sort of segue to Rifat's If I Must Die, a video that went viral.
If I must die, you must live. To tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite. My kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
Scottish actor Brian Cox, you know, who played in Succession, reciting Rifat Al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die, in a video that went viral. And you can go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Rifat just before he was killed. In your book, Mus'ab Abu Toha, Forest of Noise,
talk about Rifat and then your kind of rejoinder to this poem.
I knew Rifat as a professor at the Islamic University of Gaza. He did not teach me, but I would say that he taught me a lot. Because when I was in my second year, he was in Malaysia finishing his PhD. And when he returned, I was already finishing my courses. But he was someone who led me to the We Are Not Numbers project that he co-founded, which is a project that offers some mentorship for young writers. I was in the beginning of my writing career. So he introduced me to the group, and that is a picture that I took with the strawberries.
We're showing an image of Rifat holding strawberries.
Yeah, we picked that strawberry, that same strawberry together in Betlehem, in my father-in-law's farm, my father-in-law's farm. I knew Rifat as a father. He was a wonderful father for his kids, and he was a lovely son of his parents. His parents still survive, I hope, in Gaza City. And he's also a professor of English literature. And we talk when we were talking about literature, he would talk about Arabic literature and also English literature. His favorite poet, I think, was John Donne. And in the Arabic language, he loved the classical Arabic poems, like Al-Asha, like Imru al-Qais, like Ibn Halliza. He would recite some Arabic poems to me, and I was amazed, you know. Before Rifat was killed, he published his poem, If I Must Die, and he posted it on his Instagram. And I read that poem, and I was still in North Gaza. It was before I was abducted. And it was very heartbreaking for me. I mean, someone writing about his death and what he wishes his death to be like. And I couldn't but try and write my own If I Must Die. But I did not call it If I Must Die. I wrote If I'm Going to Die. But after he was killed, I retitled the poem, which is now called A Request. A Request After Rifat al-Arair. If I am going to die, let it be a clean death. No rubble over my corpse, no broken dishes or glasses, and not many cuts in my head or chest. Leave my ironed, untouched jackets and pants in the closet, so I may wear some of them again at my funeral. Yeah.
Musab Abu Toha reading from his new second book of poetry, Forest of Noise. Just months after Rifat was killed, his eldest daughter, Shaima Rifat al-Arir, was also killed in an Israeli strike in Gaza, along with her husband and two-month-old son, Rifat's grandchild.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine, I mean, Rifat became a grandfather after he was killed. He became a grandfather after he was killed. And I mean, something that breaks my heart, just as it must break everyone's heart, is that when someone is killed, they even don't know who was killed with them. They don't know. Rifat did not know that his daughter Shaima and her husband Abdurrahman al-Siyam, I think his name, and his grandchild were killed after him. I mean, I don't know whether he knows about this. Whether he's now feeling a lot of pain knowing about this. So it is a campaign of killing the father, the mother, the sister. I would call this not only a genocide. It's not only a genocide against a people, but it's also a genocide against families. Because when you look at the names of the people who are killed, you see the name of the father, the mother, the children, the grandchildren. It's not about killing five people from the street or five people in the mosque or the school. It's killing a whole family. When I tell you that I lost 31 members of my extended family, I talk about two first cousins with their husband and their children. I'm not talking about my cousin, no. Her husband, their children, the youngest two or four.
Musab, can you look into this camera and share your message with the world, what you want the world to take away right now about what's happening in your home in Gaza?
I mean, if the world cannot really help us, I hope that they will not continue to support the oppressor. If you can't really stop this, why don't you just go away? I mean, I wish the world was ignoring us. No, they are not ignoring us. No, they are contributing to our suffering and the genocidal campaign that Israel has been launching not since last year, since 76 years. I mean, I mean, maybe you just mentioned that that Blinken would says that in a few days, you know, the negotiations would start again. I mean, why don't you say the same things about sending the weapons to Israel? Why don't you, in a few days we will try and send the Israelis some new weapons? Why don't you take your time and think about what these weapons are going to do? Why does it take time to resume negotiations and force the Israelis to stop their killing of my people? Why does it take time? Why is it difficult to stop this, but it's easy to send more and more weapons? Just leave us alone.
Your choice of a last poem to share with our audience around the world. Would you like to share The Moon, or Right or Left, or Under the Rubble?
Well, Under the Rubble is long, so I would just go with Right or Left, which is a poem that I wrote for one of my friend's sisters. My friend himself was killed with his parents, with his with four of his sisters, with his two children. So the only survivors were his wife and two other sisters. So the body of my friend Ismail Abu Ghabin, the body of his sister, 16 years old, and his father are still under the rubble. So I wrote this poem about the bodies that remained under the rubble, the body of his sister. Right or left? Under the rubble, her body has remained for days and days. When the war ends, we try to remove the rubble, stone after stone. We only find one small bone from her body. It is a bone from her arm. Right or left? It does not matter, as long as we cannot find the henna from her neighbor's wedding on her skin, or the ink from a school pen on a little index finger.
Masab Abu Toha, Palestinian poet and author, his new second book of poetry, Forest of Noise, has just been published. His previous award-winning book is called Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. Masab Abu Toha is a columnist, teacher, founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza, which we'll talk about in part two of our conversation and post online. And also, I hope Masab will read Under the Rubble, and we'll post it at democracynow.org. Masab, thank you for joining us in our New York studio.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Next up, the BRICS summit has just wrapped up. We'll be joined by two economists. Stay with us.
Capitalist system, and I'll tell you the reason why. It has caused me so much suffering, and my dearest friends to die. Well, I know you all are wondering what it has done to me. Well, I am going to tell you that my husband has TB, brought on by hard work and low wages and never enough to eat, from going cold and hungry with no shoes upon his feet. My husband was a coal miner who worked hard and risked his life just trying to support three children, himself, his mother and wife. Well, I had a blue-eyed baby, was a darling of my heart. But from my little darling,
I Hate the Capitalist System by the late, great Barbara Dane. She passed away this week at the age of 97. By the way, Masab Abu Toha will be speaking and reading his poetry at New York University, NYU, today at 5 at the Lillian Vernon House. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a summit of BRICS nations that concluded Thursday in the Russian city of Kazan as President Putin made a comeback to the global stage, hosting 36 world leaders and representatives from countries including China, India, South Africa, Iran, even Palestine. Israel's war on Gaza took center stage with many heads of states demanding an immediate ceasefire. Putin also faced direct calls at the summit from some of Russia's most important allies, from Moscow to end the war in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the BRICS coalition, which was founded by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, officially added 13 new nations to the alliance's partner countries, including Bolivia, Cuba, Nigeria, and Turkey. For more, we're joined by two guests here in New York, Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School, founder of Democracy at Work, author of several books, including most recently Understanding Capitalism. And in Johannesburg, South Africa, we're joined by the political economist Patrick Bond, distinguished professor and director of the Center for Social Change at the University of Johannesburg. His recent Counterpunch article headlined Rising Dangers of Imperial and Sub-Imperial Partnering. We're going to begin with you, Patrick. Talk about the significance of this BRICS summit.
I must quickly say thank you for having me, but also in 10 or 11 days, you may know whether the great teams at Democracy at Work and Democracy Now! Need to be in exile because democracy won't be allowed. And you'll come to Johannesburg and we'll have you a very fine site for your production systems. It's a great address here at the moment. And I think the fact that we had the BRICS summit just 14 months ago, I was chatting and debating with Vijay Prashad along with my colleague Trevor Ngwani. And it means that in the current period where the de-dollarization rhetoric coming up to this BRICS, because Russia hosting it and being shut out of the SWIFT system, having $600 and some billion seized illegally by the Western banks and not getting loans, even from the BRICS New Development Bank, suffering sanctions. That meant a lot of attention has been on whether Vladimir Putin and his team can generate a de-dollarization strategy. Unfortunately, that didn't transpire. And then since we've just come out of the Israeli genocide story, not using genocide in the Kazan declaration on Wednesday night, not calling for sanctions, even though the United Nations General Assembly effectively did last month, and not acknowledging that 9 out of the 10 BRICS countries have very profitable relationships, like South Africa, number one coal exporter to Israel, and China and India having companies that run the Haifa port. Hey, you could turn those off and really put pressure on Israel if they really had the guts, but we see them talking left, walking right.
And Richard Wolff, your takeaway from this BRICS summit, how historic was it?
In my judgment, and even though Patrick is right about a number of his criticisms, this is a historic turning point. I cannot overstress it. Here we have, for the first time in a century, a serious economic competitor to the United States and its role in the world. We've never seen this before in the lifetimes you, me, and the people watching this program and listening to it. Here are a group of countries that together have a larger GDP, a greater production than the G7, the United States and its allies. We haven't had that before, and the gap between them is growing. The economic growth of the United States this year by the IMF is scheduled to be 2.8%. In China, 4.8%. In India, 7%. So they are growing faster than we are. They've been doing it for decades. It is a new economic world. And as an economist and an American, I am aghast that our presidential election isn't putting that front and forward. This is a new world. Everybody else in the world is adjusting to this reality. The American empire and our system is in a decline relative to what the BRICS are about. Are there problems among them? For sure. Do they have their faults? Absolutely. This is not good and bad, but it is a radical alteration. And if we continue as a nation to pretend it isn't happening or it isn't important, we will continue to make big strategic mistakes, not the least of which is to bring us into a war kind of situation that people are already sensing might be in the air.
I want to go to Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, for his comments at the BRICS summit.
We're in touch with the leadership of Iran, in a very close contact. We see our role in creating conditions to settling the situation by finding mutual compromises. I think it is possible.
Patrick Bond, your response, the Russia-Iranian alliance, and also the latest news that North Korea is sending soldiers to Russia, perhaps to fight in Ukraine.
Well, those conflicts, Russia-Ukraine, are just so tragic, since several hundred thousand Ukrainian working-class people and maybe 100,000 Russians have been killed in what is a power grab that I think goes outside my line of argument that it's a sub-imperial. It's a rogue sub-imperial, the way Janet Yellen's rogue imperial grab of all those assets could be described. But, you know, if I come back to where Richard was saying that this is an alternative, it's something new, it's a real challenge, I must fight you on that, my old friend, because I think there's not an anti-imperial, but a sub-imperial, not against, but within. Just think of the global value chain, my phone that has the cobalt from child labor in China, in Chinese mines in the eastern DRC, then coming back into to a Western phone. And these are the sorts of relationships we really have to be restructuring, not just a sort of shifting of the deck chairs on a global capitalist Titanic. Certainly as the multilateral system expands. Next month, there will be, you know, a G20. Last year in Delhi, the African Union was added. As it expands to have more legitimacy without changing the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO in any substantive way, the BRICS are playing a greater role, I think, in amplifying the worst aspects. Just as one final example, the 51% of global emissions come from these 10 countries, but they only produce 29% of GDP. What it means is that the BRICS next month go to Azerbaijan for the COP29. I'm sure Democracy Now, as usual, will go there and do cutting-edge analysis. You'll find that the BRICS and the West are tightly allied against the rest of us.
Last word goes to Richard Wolff.
Yeah, history does not happen in a morality play. You're not going to have the bad disappear and replaced by the good. It's never worked that way. What you have to have is an analysis of what's actually going on. And the unanimity, the dominance of the United States is over. And the whole world is trying to figure out, every company in the world, every country, how do you navigate a new international order? The United States is pretending that, as a nation, it doesn't have to worry about this. And I'm afraid Patrick's remarks will lead people to think, well, there's problems on their side too, which there are, but that misses the larger historical phenomena. This is the first serious economic competition this country has faced, and the consequences of that will be overwhelming to us.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Richard Wolff, economics professor, visiting professor at the New School, and Patrick Bond, professor at the University of Johannesburg. That does it for our show. Yes, Democracy Now! Will be in Baku, Azerbaijan, covering the UN Climate Summit in mid-November. And tune in on election night, Tuesday, November 5th, for a four-hour Democracy Now! Election special, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Join us from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern, and any television or radio station can take the broadcast as well. We'll also be airing an expanded two-hour election show on Wednesday, November 6th. That does it for our show. Check out our job listings at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Wednesday, November 13th at 6 p.m., it's our monthly open mic night at The Grind, presented by The Grind and 93.3 CFMU. Open Mic Night at The Grind features singers, songwriters, poets, and performers, as well as great food and drink. Come out and enjoy, or come and participate. It doesn't matter if you play original music on the guitar, sing musical numbers to a backing track on your phone, write poetry in your spare time, come and share what you've got. Drop by The Grind and sign up now. Ask at the counter for the sign-up list. That list filled up quickly last month, so come on by, sign up. You can find The Grind in Toko Salmon Hall, just outside of the Student Center. Open Mic Night at The Grind, Wednesday, November 13th, from 6 to 9 p.m.